You are listening to an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News.
Good afternoon. This is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News, broadcasting from the Sea Ranch, California on Friday, May the 1st. Our topic today is hypogonadism in women. This is distinct from menopause. However, some of the issues that surround treatment for these disorders overlap. Menopause is, of course, the cessation of normal menses, signaling the end of the reproductive cycle in a woman who has normal pituitary and ovarian function. Hypogonadism could be related to ovarian disease, but for all intents and purposes and through Pituitary World News, most of the time what we are talking about is patients who have hypothalamic or pituitary disorders, with the caveat that many of our patients have had a hysterectomy and had their ovaries removed before presenting with their pituitary disease. The average age of menopause is at about 51 and a half years. Menopause occurs because the ovaries have simply run out of eggs. After menopause, estrogen levels fall and the FSH and LH levels rise. Menopause is considered normal if it occurs after age 40. The terminology around hypogonadism in women is rather complex. For example, ovarian failure is called primary ovarian failure, whereas those patients who have hypothalamic or pituitary disease are thought to have central hypogonadism. Some refer to pituitary dysfunction as secondary hypogonadism and hypothalamic dysfunction as tertiary hypogonadism. Primary amenorrhea is failure to ever have menses at the time of puberty, whereas secondary amenorrhea is the lack of menses in a woman who has previously had normal menses. The average age of menses is becoming earlier with every decade, especially in well-developed countries where nutrition is adequate, and probably averages age 11 to 12 years. We consider menses not taking place by age 14 to be a problem deserving of further investigation. Let's review some of the normal physiology, then we can talk about some of the causes of hypogonadism. There are complex things going on in the brain that we do not fully understand that regulate our gonadal systems and our reproductive functions. We know, for example, that severe psychological stress, intense physical activity, or low body weight can shut down the reproductive systems. There are neurons in the hypothalamus called gonadotropin-releasing hormone-secreting neurons that secrete gonadotropin-releasing hormone in a pulsatile fashion every 90 minutes. This pulsatility is essential to normal function of the pituitary, which produces LH and FSH. LH stands for luteinizing hormone, while FSH stands for follicle-stimulating hormone. Both of these hormones are secreted in pulses that are trained to the rhythm of the GnRH-producing cells in the hypothalamus. These cells are relatively quiescent until puberty, when most of the LH and FSH is produced at night during sleep, and then in adulthood after puberty, the LH and FSH is produced throughout the day in a series of pulses that varies in amplitude and frequency from one individual to the next. FSH stimulates the follicle cells in the ovary to produce estrogens and to recruit eggs for ultimate release, while as LH changes the follicle cells and leads to ovulation. There are a lot of complex things going on in the ovary, and I won't belabor those points here, but suffice it to say that a number of other proteins and hormones are made that influence pituitary function, and the two most important ones are known as inhibin and activin. The menstrual cycle is one of the more complex cycles of the human physiology. And I want to try to simplify that for you now. On the first day of a menstrual cycle, which is considered the first day of that particular period, estrogen and progesterone levels are low. The low estrogen and progestin levels lead to FSH production by the pituitary gland because of the lack of negative feedback on FSH production. LH levels also rise. FSH causes the cells surrounding an egg to proliferate and to produce estrogens. In fact, testosterone is produced first, and then testosterone is converted to estrogen. As the estrogen levels rise throughout the first few days of a period, they lead to a little bit of LH stimulation, and then that increases throughout the middle of the period such that there is what's called an LH spike. That spike leads to ovulation, and then LH converts the remaining follicle cells left over from where the egg was released into what's called the corpus luteum. The corpus luteum produces progesterone. If a pregnancy does not occur, the corpus luteum dies in about 14 days, and this leads to progesterone levels falling. While all of this has been going on in the ovary, the uterine lining has responded to the estrogens and the progestins as well. And then if pregnancy does not occur, when the progesterone levels fall, the uterine lining dies and sloughs off, leading to the start of the next month's menstrual period. This is an extremely and tightly regulated and coordinated system. If it is working correctly, a woman will usually have menses about every 28 to 30 days. Variations in cycle length are normal and can be influenced by time of the year, stress, body weight, other medical conditions, certain medications, etc. Something that I find to be rather interesting is that the ovaries contain about 4 million eggs when a woman is in her mother's womb developing. By the time she is born, only about 10% or 400,000 of those eggs remain. The rest have simply died off through a process known as atresia. By the time the girl goes through pregnancy, there are even significantly less eggs. And, if one were to presume a reproductive length of 40 years with no pregnancies and completely normal menses, only about 480 eggs would be ovulated during the lifetime of a woman. With each menstrual cycle, there are 3 to 5 eggs that are recruited, but only the strongest and best one is selected for ovulation. The remaining ones die. The age of menopause is probably largely dependent on number of pregnancies and also the genetic potential or number of eggs that a woman is born with. Starting menses early does not seem to influence the age of menopause. We do know that smoking does cause menopause to occur a year or two earlier in most women who use tobacco products. Now, before we move on to the causes of hypogonadism, let's review the effects of prolactin. Prolactin is a hormone that basically prepares the breast for breastfeeding. It does a number of things within the breast to lead to the production and, when suckling occurs, the release of milk. Prolactin inhibits the normal periodic cyclicity of gonadotropin-releasing hormone production by the hypothalamus. Thus, women who have elevated prolactin levels have suppression of GnRH production, discoordinated LH and FSH release, and can develop hypogonadism. I defined the types of hypogonadism earlier. What I want you to try to understand now is that hypogonadism can be partial or complete. And for example, in complete hypogonadism, a woman may not produce any estrogens whatsoever and have all the classic symptoms and signs of estrogen deficiency. Partial hypogonadism may be manifest simply as irregular periods or even just infertility. The best test for hypogonadism in women is to simply take a reproductive and a menstrual history. If a woman is having menstrual periods at all, and especially if they are about every 4 to 6 weeks, then she is not hypogonadal, but might have some subtle alterations in the pituitary control over the ovaries. Obviously, if a woman is not having menstrual periods at all, then there might be a problem. Some patients, however, are simply not ovulating. The best test in this case is to give 10 days of a progestin. If a woman has a period within 7 to 10 days after discontinuing the progestin, then we know that her pituitary and ovaries are working together to produce sufficient amounts of estrogen, but she is not ovulating. Of course, measurements of estrogen, progesterone, FSH, LH, and prolactin are essential in any patient who is not having regular menses and has a history of pituitary disease. Those patients with primary ovarian failure will have low estradiol levels and very high levels of LH and FSH. Those patients with central hypogonadism will usually have low or low normal estradiol levels and inappropriately normal LH and FSH levels. Sometimes the LH and FSH are undetectable. Of course, elevated prolactin levels define hyperprolactinemia and a consideration of the different causes of hyperprolactinemia. As you know, the presence of galactorrhea or breast milk production is often the first evidence that a patient may be hyperprolactinemic, but this finding is not universal in patients with hyperprolactinemia. Furthermore, not every woman with breast milk production has a high prolactin level. Other symptoms of hypogonadism may include recurrent urinary tract infections, vaginal dryness, breast atrophy, depression, moodiness, hot flashes and flushes, and many of the other symptoms and signs of menopause. So in regards to the causes of hypogonadism, they are numerous, and basically anything and everything that affects the hypothalamic pituitary unit can cause hypogonadism in women, as can ovarian surgical removal or genetic defects of the ovaries, for example. Pituitary tumors, craniopharyngiomas, prolactinomas, other causes of hyperprolactinemia are probably the most common things that I see in my practice. A couple of things worthy of mention, however, include Kallmann syndrome, which is a genetic defect where the GnRH-producing neurons do not migrate to the hypothalamus and thus lead to what we would refer to as tertiary or hypogonadotropic hypogonadism, and failure of the whole reproductive system because these cells aren't located in the proper place. Another one would be Sheehan syndrome, which usually occurs as a consequence of low blood pressure or low blood volume, often with obstetrical catastrophe and hemorrhage, which I find to be rather ironic because it's the obstetrical disorder that leads to reproductive failure and pituitary failure in those patients, but the irony is not lost there. Another thing worthy of mention is that of post-pill amenorrhea. Birth control pills, by design, have too much estrogen and progesterone for the body, so they suppress the pituitary so that you do not stimulate the ovaries. After discontinuation of birth control pills, it may take 3 to 6 months for the pituitary and the hypothalamus to recover from this suppression and be able to coordinate the ovary in a fashion such as to lead to normal ovulation. However, I want you to know that some patients have developed hyperprolactinemia or worsening of their hyperprolactinemia during birth control therapy, And any woman who does not regain menses within 6 months after discontinuing birth control pills probably should be evaluated for hyperprolactinemia. I want to wrap up this podcast with a few personal thoughts. And I think the most prominent or obvious one is the fact that I have seen a number of patients with pituitary diseases, and the very first manifestation, when we go back through the history, that they had a pituitary problem was the fact that their menses were abnormal or they were infertile, and their physicians, even gynecologists, had not paid attention to the fact that the menses were abnormal. In fact, one of the things that many patients have been told was that, well, all of my patients have abnormal menses, so the finding was dismissed. So if your periods are not normal, talk to your physician and demand an explanation. It might be something as simple as polycystic ovary disease, metabolic syndrome, or some other problem, but certainly get an evaluation and get some answers. I think another thing I would want to relate to you is that it's important to keep in mind that hormone replacement for women with hypogonadism is different from hormone replacement in a menopausal woman. Some of the issues are the same, and we'll cover those in a future podcast on hormone replacement. But keep in mind that if you're 25 or 30 and have hypogonadism, the issues about the safety and efficacy of estrogens, although important, is different than it is for your mother who might be 55 and having ceased her menses. And certainly the approaches to treatment and the drug doses are different as well. That's all for now. This has been Lewis Blevins for Pituitary World News. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for the next podcast on hormone replacement in women with hypogonadism. Have a wonderful day.